From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the January edition of the Bletchley Park podcast with me, Catherine Lynch, and producer Mark Cotton. Now, it's another packed year at Bletchley Park in 2013, and we'll have some new events this year, as well as the firm favourites like the Enigma Reunion, Blitz Night and the 40s Festival. Bletchley Park is always a fantastic day out, but this year we've got more special events, including some exciting new ones.
Now, I've seen a list of some of these new events that we've got coming up in 2013. Can you take us through some of them specifically?
Well, how about New Enigma? There you can find out what it takes to be a code breaker. Do you think you've got what it takes?
Oh, I don't know about that.
Right back in the days of GC and CS, up to GCHQ in Cheltenham today, and what they're looking for in their new wave of recruits.
So that'll be looking at code breaking in the future then. So what about Codebreakers Legacy that we've got on November the 9th?
That's a team of top speakers. It's quite a prestigious event. They'll explore the work of the Codebreakers, not just Alan Turing, who we hear a lot about, especially last year in his centenary year, but also the likes of Dilly Knox, Gordon Welchman, Max Newman and many others. They'll be delving into how they've influenced the world we live in today.
It's nice that we'll be bringing some of the other Codebreakers that aren't always in the story to more people's attention. I noticed another event here. Are you listening?
Are you? That'll be celebrating communications throughout history. And we'll go right back to when we relied on pigeons, through the beginnings of the post office, right through radio waves, up to the first televisions, and it will bring it bang up to date with the internet and the digital age we live in now. And of course, Bletchley Park's role in all of that, and the rapid development there was during the war, but then the secrecy that surrounded that and how that technology was taken forward afterwards. That event is on the 5th and 6th of October.
I mean, all in all, we thought 2012 had been a really busy year, especially with the Alan Turing year, but it's looking like 2013 is going to be even more busy.
Bletchley Park is ever-growing, so of course our events calendar grows with us, and we want to attract more people to look at some different subjects and experience different aspects of not only the history of this place, but the future of code-breaking. And GCHQ is wanting to recruit more people, so we're keen to be part of that this year.
So we'll be telling people about these events as they come up during the year in the podcast, but where can people go online to find out more about them?
Bletchley Park's website is bletchleypark.org.uk. All the details are on there. Forty years ago, a group of teenage boys turned up at Bletchley Park to start their apprenticeships with the Civil Aviation Authority. Just like the Codebreakers 30 years before them, they had to sign the Official Secrets Act, because this was 2 years before the first details began to emerge about the ultra-secret war work carried out here. They went on to complete 3 years' training to become air traffic controllers. They came back to Bletchley Park for the first time to celebrate their 40th anniversary with a reunion. And while they were here, they spoke to Jessica Cooper from BBC Three Counties Radio.
Firstly, if somebody could explain the work that you used to do here.
The Civil Aviation Signals Training Establishment, they had Block D in the park, and it was a training school to train engineers for air traffic control.
Our job as engineers when we were qualified was to maintain all the radio systems, the radar systems and all the airport equipment.
And you started that work in 1972, 40 years ago. How long were you based here at the park for then?
Okay, well, we were about here about 3 years in total, weren't we? And part of that was field training. We did a number of things here. We went to the CASTE school. We were trained specifically on radio systems, radio equipment. We also went to college over at Wolverton, where we got our kind of national diplomas. And then they sent us off around the country to various stations with various degrees of mayhem caused by us. There were good times, and it was very good fun to work here. And then we were sent off around the country to posted to various stations around the country. This was the educational part of it, our apprenticeship.
What was a normal day for you like then when you were here at Bletchley Park?
We stayed in digs nearby. Used to start work around 8:30 in the morning and had to sign in. They used to take the book away at 8:30, and then we had to go to the office and sign it and admit to being late. And then mainly classroom work in the morning, and then the afternoons was mainly practical work, building an amplifier. Well, that went on for probably about 6 months altogether.
Were you aware of the link with the co-breakers to Bletchley Park?
I mean, we were almost 30 years beyond the war at that time. Everybody knew that the park had been used during the war for something that was top secret, and nobody really spoke about it, nobody in the community spoke about it. But within the park itself, there was some knowledge of what had been going on, but there was nothing really until the 30-year secret started to come out in the mid-70s did it become more known about what had gone on here.
There were still parts of the park, certain blocks, that we were not allowed to go into, and the park in those days was a secure site, so there were still armed guards and very serious security. So although we didn't really know exactly what was going on, we knew something was going on.
What did it feel like then to know that you were allowed to be here when it had this secret attached to it?
I don't know if I was that aware of it, because there was also the teacher training college on site. I got to know a lot of the students there, so there was this kind of light-hearted atmosphere as well within the park. There was a lot of people coming and going. There were other groups like BT, the GPO as I think it then was, on the site, and there are other people training. So, to be honest, personally, I wasn't that aware of it. It was a buzz to be here. The course was great, and these guys were great. I mean, we all got on really well, didn't we, guys?
Mm-hmm.
And so our particular group bonded very well, and we had a lot of fun.
Being back here, now you know a bit more about the park and those secrets have come out. What's it like being back here today, then?
It's fascinating to be back, and I mean primarily to sort of meet each other. We haven't all got together like this really since the course finished. But in some ways, I think it's a little bit sad that we didn't know what went on here when we were here, because perhaps we could have taken more interest and made a bit more of it. Mm. But, you know, it really wasn't apparent to us.
Up until about 5 years ago was the first time I ever managed to get into the mansion, because you get stopped at the door. This was GPO had this mansion, British Telecom, that ran it. And we were all lodger units. The mansion was just foreboding. You just couldn't get in.
Mm-hmm.
Does it feel quite different now?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's very different. It's kind of more of a theme park now. And that's good, because it's really good to recognise the work of those people who made such a tremendous contribution, you know, to the war and after the war. So it is, yeah, it does feel very different now. A very fascinating place, and I'm just amazed to discover it all, rediscover it, if you like, and what happened here.
Looking forward to the future of Bletchley Park, what do you kind of hope to see here in years to come?
I'd like to see the buildings fully restored. I found it quite surprising how dilapidated they've become. Mm. I think that needs doing first. Just keep the whole thing going permanently as a museum.
Yeah, I think so. And that it can be developed as, you know, code breaking and all these kind of communications develops itself. I think it's the right place for that to be recognised and developed. And this is where the computer age started, right here. And we didn't realise it. It wasn't America, not Japan, right here in Bletchley Park. Amazing.
I haven't been back here since 74, 75.
Mm.
And I remember it as a very drab place of Nissen huts.
Mm.
And, yeah, I'd like to see it perhaps brought back into more how it was soon after the war. Hopefully there are still some people around who can be found who can put it back into that situation. Because although for us it was the start of a career and a very good training, clearly what happened during the war years was a sort of world-changing series of events, and I think that's what the park should rightly focus on. What I still have is the exercise piece of electronics that we all had to build as part of our apprenticeship. And this is a little circuit board, I suppose it's about the size of an iPhone, with very old-fashioned components on, which was the start of an audio amplifier. This is where we developed our electronics maintenance skills. This would have been built in 72. We basically had to keep working on it until it worked.
And, how long did that take then?
I'm not sure, but I do remember that we had one of the lecturers, Mr. Twig. His nickname was Snip Snip. Because not only did we have to make it work, but the workmanship had to be perfect. And if the workmanship wasn't perfect, he would come along with his pliers and go, snip, snip, do it again. So this has probably been made three times over until it was good enough to pass his standards.
Thanks for getting that.
Half 10 is bummer.
Yeah.
It's funny to see that.
It was amazing, yeah, to see it. Yeah. He wheeled it out last night over dinner. And it was...
And I
was in tears.
I actually gave the amplifier to my landlord.
Oh, right.
And he used it for years.
Yeah.
So it worked.
It worked.
It has worked.
Well, thanks so much for chatting
to
me.
Yeah, okay,
you're welcome,
yeah.
Enjoy the rest of your visit.
There's no avoiding it. It's that time of year. January is when many of us decide to get fit and challenge ourselves. So why not make a double whammy of it this year and raise some much-needed funds for the Bletchley Park Trust at the same time? Cycling is hugely popular at the moment, thanks at least partly to Bradley Wiggins and Team GB's multiple successes last year, so it could be time to channel some of their triumphant spirit and set yourself a challenge for 2013 by entering the London to Paris or the London to Brighton bike ride. I chewed this idea over with the Bletchley Park Trust's CEO, Ian Standen, who challenged himself ever so slightly last year by entering the first ever Milton Keynes Marathon. Was it your first marathon?
It wasn't my first marathon. No, I'd done marathons before, and I'd already got in the back of my mind I would do the Milton Keynes one when I arrived here, but one was firmly twisted up my back when I first arrived that I ought to be doing it and running for Bletchley Park, which was great. It was an appalling day. The weather was absolutely atrocious.
It was dire, I remember.
Blowing gales, driving wind. No, didn't drown, and ended up running another half mile more than planned because they diverted us halfway round because the original route was flooded. But nonetheless, it was still not a bad time, and I raised £15,000. So
brilliant.
I can't complain, really.
Are you doing it again this year?
I'm not sure. I'm getting older and older. I might do, but what I do is I like to encourage other people to get out there and do it. I think the Milton Keynes Marathon is being run again in May, and it would be great to see some people running for the park. But also, of course, you see on our website, we've got the London to Paris bike ride, which we're encouraging people to get involved with. So if you feel like you want to do something a bit energetic in 2013, why not get out on your bike or on your feet and raise some money for Bletchley Park?
And there was huge celebration and commemoration of Alan Turing's life and achievements last year because it was his centenary year. This year, the London to Paris bike ride arrives in Paris on Alan Turing's birthday. So if you want to do your little bit to mark, that could be another way into it for you. Because he was a keen cyclist, wasn't he, as well as a runner?
As I said before on these podcasts, he competed in the Olympic trials in 1948 and only just failed to get a place in the Olympic team. But yeah, certainly used to cycle. By all accounts, used to cycle in from his digs around the local area to Bletchley Park when he worked here. So yeah, a very fitting tribute to him. And what really is the end of the Turing centenary, it really sort of ran from his birthday to his birthday next year. So a very fitting way to end the year.
I've started a 12-week plan that should end with me being able to do a half marathon. Ask me again in a month and I'll let you know how I'm getting on.
Any opportunity to get out there and raise some money will be gratefully accepted.
Senior cryptographer Captain Jerry Roberts was awarded an MBE in the New Year's honours. Captain Roberts was one of four founding members of the Testery, the section which worked on the Lorenz cipher system used by Hitler and the High Command. He said he was delighted but had mixed feelings about the honour because he felt it didn't go far enough in recognising the achievements of his colleagues. He's tirelessly campaigned for better recognition for those who broke Lorenz, also known as Tunny, for the last 4 years. We'll bring you more on this in the next podcast. The Bletchley Park Trust has been celebrating its 21st birthday. The founding volunteers want to thank the thousands of people who helped to save Bletchley Park from the bulldozers and who've turned it into a success story befitting of the World War II codebreakers. Last month, over tea and cakes in Sue and Peter Jarvis's living room, where it all began, the Jarvises and fellow founding volunteer and historian Peter Westcombe remembered how they first heard that Bletchley Park was in peril. Cast your minds back to when you first became aware of what happened at Bletchley Park, if you were to.
Oh, that's going back a bit.
It is, rather. In 1960, I joined the Diplomatic Wireless Service at Hounslow Park, and we, in fact, used Hut 3 in the park as our dormitory for people coming back and forth from overseas. So when I joined, I moved into Hut 3. So the whole thing then fell into sort of in the sidelines until, well, 1974, the full story came out. British Intelligence in the Second World War, the 5-volume by Harry Hinsley et al., was published. And I read that in the public library or part of it and realised, oh, my God, Bletchley Park is important. But then, of course, by that time, I was going backwards and forwards overseas. I did a tour of Beirut from 1963 to 1966. When I got back, that's when I met Sue and Peter through the Bletchley Archaeological Society. And so that's how we got together.
Sue and I came to a very different path, didn't we? We first heard about Bletchley Park in 1961.
because I'm a member of the Cymdeithas Nefiaethu Cymru, the Welsh National Archaeological Organisation, and the secretary, who was a very senior civil servant, had seen our engagement and our wedding in the papers. He said, "Where have you gone to live?" And we said, "Bletchley." He said, "Oh," he said, "Bletchley? Anywhere near Bletchley Park?" And I said, "About half a mile away." He said, "Well, can't talk about it, obviously," he said, "but keep your eyes and ears open. It'll come out one day, because something very odd indeed happened there." So after that, I kept my eyes and ears open. I learnt things, little bits of the jigsaw puzzle. I never got the whole picture, anything like.
There was a meeting of the Milton Keynes Council in which they were discussing the future of Bletchley Park. And Peter and I discussed it in the Archaeological Society. We went down to that meeting to see what they would say. And much to our horror, they wanted Bletchley Park flattened because they were going to sell the place off for development. That's then when we started to sort of get the steamroller going to flatten any ideas they had about destroying Bletchley Park.
Yeah. Did it get as far as planning permission being granted?
The council never got round to it.
No, they didn't.
They put a block on the whole. Actually, the point was the old Development Corporation was in charge of this back in those days. They didn't know about it.
No.
They knew nothing.
You've got 55 acres of ground right by the side of the railway station, so people living here climb out of bed in the morning, clean their teeth, have a meal, straight across the road on the way to London. No parking, no problem at all. They've got their own supermarket, they've got their petrol station. It's a nice little unit. It was a very, very valuable site indeed. We jump forward then really to 1991. In 1991, it really started with Rowan and myself. I said, "Now look," I said, "we're going to do something about Bletchley Park. I'm coming up to retirement." And so Rowena said to me, that's why I said, "Now look," she said, "you need something to do during retirement, so I'm not going to have you hanging around the house." I then said, "Well, look, we really must sort out what we're going to do about Bletchley Park." She said, "OK, go for it." "Now, who do I approach? Who do I talk to?" I said, "I don't know anybody, because I spent all my life overseas, we all had." And so she said, "Go and see Peter and Sue. Peter's a local GP. He knows everybody for miles around. Member of the Archaeological Society, he can put it in contact with the people." So then that's what happened. So then Rowena and I invited ourselves down here to tea. And I said, "Look, Peter, what are we going to do about the park? You know, that as far as the council are concerned, it's a dead duck, and they're going to get rid of it on there, nothing on there. How the hell are we going to stop it happening?" So Peter said, "Well, I don't know, we've got to think of something." And then, of course, we came up with the suggestion of the Bletchley Archaeological Society. What I said was, "Look, why don't we have a big farewell bash of all the codebreakers in the park? I could get their names, because I had contacts. We'll go and see the Bletchley Archaeological Society committee." So that's how the whole thing really took off, that we got the meeting on there, because, you see, if Peter and I and Sue and my wife had written and said, "We invite you to a big farewell party in Bletchley Park before it's demolished," they'd say, "Who the hell is Peter Westman and Peter Jarvis?" But if you say the chairman of the committee of the Bletchley Archaeological Society invites you, then of course you have some clout. By 1991, Bletchley Park had been empty for years. This is where the whole thing starts, the ball starts to roll, because we suggested we go and see the Bletchley Archaeological Society. They said, "Fine." So they came here and had a committee meeting. The chairman of the Archaeological Society said, "Yes, we'll organise writing all the invitations out if I got the information for them." So then I said, "Well, I've got to go into the park and see if we get permission to go into the park." So I went down to see Doreen. So she said, "You can use what was the old upstairs canteen in E Block." So we got the place organised for the party. The Archaeological Society wrote the letters, and then said to the people, "Then now, can you give me other names and addresses?" And it went on and on and on and on. I read British intelligence of the Second World War. Churchill came to visit in September
1941.
And he came up and they said, "What a wonderful job you've done." So they said, "That's all very well, thank you for all this." They said, "But we are stifled. We've got no men, we've got no staff, we've got no accommodation to do it, no typists, nothing at all." So four of them wrote this letter to Churchill.
Turing, Welchman, Alexander and Milner Barry.
Yeah, so they wrote this letter. They said to Stuart Milner Barry, "You're the youngest, get down to Whitehall and give this personally to Churchill." So he got down there, of course, his young kid as he was then, and eventually he got the letter to Churchill. Churchill took one look at the letter, read it, and said to General Ismay, "Action this day, get it done and let me know." And now I realise in May 1991 that 6 months later would be exactly the anniversary of this famous letter. So I said to Peter and said, "Look, let's make this the date for the party, this great celebration on there." And the idea was not we're going to have a party, the idea was to call it the press, the media, everybody, and say, "Listen to these people talk. Listen to the stories they've got to tell. Well, you're not going to destroy a site like this." That's why we got the group of them together. So all the two invites went out.
And at the party, the codebreaker said, "Well, let us write to the Prime Minister again."
Yes.
So they did.
They did.
And Milner Barry took this one as well.
I got hold of GCHQ because of my job and said, "Hey, we've got this big meeting going on of all the old probe makers. Can we, in fact, borrow, just for the day, an Enigma machine? Next thing I know, it's a diplomatic bag with a four-rotor Enigma in it. So I'll bring it home and phone Peter and say, Peter, bring up your camera quick. We're never going to see another one again. Come and photograph this Enigma machine. I got a whole series of slides of all the code breakers there standing by the side of this blessed machine. Yeah. I mean, if you remember on that party, on the 19th of October, everyone was sort of talking about what they did here. And I actually walked round the park, round the lake, with Harry Hensley, Stuart Milner-Parry and Edward Thomas, Captain Edward Thomas on the Aerosup 4. And they started talking, not about the stuff they'd done, the code breaking. What they started talking about was the fun they had. And Stuart Milner-Parry said to Harry Hensley, do you remember your 21st birthday when you, you know, because he was, I mean, he was a miner's son, actually.
He's a wagoner's son.
And he said, well, they had to buy him a pair of grey flannel trousers because he didn't have any. And then he said, well, I remember the party. They said, yes, do you remember, Harry said, Stuart, do you remember, in fact, that you got drunk and you rode your cycle into the park and went straight into the lake? And when we fished you out, the first thing he says is, please don't tell Hillary. Now, Hillary was a girlfriend who was later his wife. Now, Hillary, who I knew quite well, was very, very proper. And the mere fact that her boyfriend, roaring drunk, had disappeared in the lake and had to be fished out would have been the end of the romance. But all he could say when he came out of the lake was, please don't tell Hillary, please don't tell Hillary. I mean, these are the sort of stories coming out. I thought, you can't destroy a park like this. You simply can't do it. So then at the end of the meeting, we then said to the assembled group, will you support us if we try and save the park? There was a silence. And I said, hang on a minute, we don't mean give us money, we mean give us your moral support. You're the people who did the job. It was a sea of arms went up, yes, we'll support you. And that's how the ball started rolling to save the park. It was at that meeting October 19th, 1991.
There was a long uphill climb from there, wasn't there, to the point at which, and I mean, there are several points in the last 21 years when you could say Bletchley Park had been saved for the nation. It's a long, long story, isn't it, and very detailed. But wasn't there at some point some tree protection orders?
The county tree man came round and he said, what have you done to the top of that sequoia dendron? So we said, well, actually, the radio people hung a shackle round it, and 30 years later, the top of the tree's dropped out. And he said, oh, dear. But he said, over there, you've got a rather nice Fagus purpurea. Yeah. And we said, but you mean that copper beech? He said, yes. And he said, beyond that, you have an exceptionally fine avenue of Cedrus Atlantica glauca. Mm-hmm. So we said, uh-huh. And he said, here, give me that. And he took this list, went round the park, drew up a list of 900 trees and put preservation orders on 300 of them. That was the end of the hypermarket.
Yeah. This was the beginning of putting the brakes on the place we developed, because if you put a TPO on and it's the roots of the tree that counts, and all the roots were interlocking, therefore they couldn't put any roads through, they couldn't put any infrastructure in. We stopped that in its tracks. The government said, no, BT owns the site or most of it. You must negotiate that we do not interfere with private enterprise. So BT said, yeah, you can have the site if you want it. By an office at sea, planning for all, I reckon about £3 million. I think between us we had about £3.50.
So how did you then get to the stage from, say, tree protection orders to where you were able to open up as a museum and got some stuff to show people?
We opened in 94. Yeah, we got a few things together and put them in the hall. DWS lent us an Enigma machine, didn't
they? That's right, yeah, 2 years. Then, for some unknown reason, GCHQ lent us the Lorenz and the Geheimschreiber, which we used to put up in Alexander Hall. Bits and pieces came together like that, but we still didn't have the house.
BT let us use the house without any sort of formal agreement.
Yeah, but we started off with the bungalow, really.
We did.
Yeah, that room you're now in the bungalow there, all of us crammed in that room together.
Sue and Rowena ran the office.
So Sue and Rowena were running the office, and also Sue and Rowena were cutting the sandwiches we were selling to visitors. But we all crammed in there together. We were in the office until such time as winter came and the tank up in the roof burst.
God, it was cold.
And all the water came down and the whole of the office was wrecked down there.
Oh, no.
So then, in fact, we moved into the house. But you see, then again in the house was a bit of a problem, because BT said, well, you better sign a lease. So it was, in fact, a maintenance lease. So, of course, there was £70,000 worth of repairs into the roof. There were ceilings falling down. Water was coming through into the ballroom. So we said, no, we'll raise the money. We will not leave. And the first guided tour, I think, had 10 people on it.
I took it.
You desperately got terribly excited. I've had 10 people on the tour. Oh, God, that was funny. That was, yeah, we thought we'd hit the high road and 10 people turned up. I mean, when it comes to the park itself and the actual way it developed to what it is now, it was a series of cliffhangers.
The Borough Council have been very kind to us, really have. It was the time, for example, when English Heritage said they'd give us £300,000 by £100,000 installments for 3 years if you found matching funding.
Yeah.
Well, we got about three and fourpence. And the Borough Council produced the other £300,000 out of the rates.
Yeah, yeah. When they realised, in fact, what the park stood for, they said, look, this is the importance of the site. This is what it did. This is why it affected the war.
Very good.
And since then, they suddenly realised, yes, we've got something. But by that time, of course, it had gone on several years. And we'd been hanging on by our fingernails for several years. And then they said, oh, crikey, yes, look what we've got in our hands.
We've got to put one of these empty shops down, but actually we took it over as a charity shop and we sold things in the park. We got a petition of 14,000 people signed it, and Bletchley's only got a population of 17,000.
The stunts we pulled to keep this place going, it wasn't all smooth running. You know, within ourselves, as the volunteer group which we were, there was all sorts of arguments went on. And we were told, don't worry, it always happens. It always happens in volunteer organisations. But because, in fact, we had these arguments, we could sort things out. We could see what, in fact, our priorities were. None of us had a business background. That's a big problem. Peter's a GP, I'm diplomatic service, and people like Roger Bistow's local councillor and so forth, Tony Sale is a technician. So that's, of course, where we kept on being hit by bills, 70,000 of this and like that. But we didn't realise across all these things that we answered up, where if we'd had a proper accountant with us, which we did, that we say, now look, watch out, there could be a problem there. This is coming up there. What are you going to do about this? We just sort of blundered that into it.
Fast forward, I think a key point was the 200-year leasehold in 1999 for the trust.
I think it was. I think it stopped the site from ever being destroyed. On the other hand, of course, I don't think it will, because it has such a high profile. It's worldwide now. You look at our visitors' books, they come, don't they, just they come all over the world to see us and to be here. The first thing is, we come to UK, we want to come to Bletchley Park. It's now a commercial organisation. People like Sue and Peter and Ryan and myself and that, we are now sort of the old brigade. We stand back and do what we want to do, take guided tours. It's the new people that take over now. And these are the other professionals. We've got a proper paid staff. And so it now runs a proper organisation. We've got accountants running the money. We've got fundraisers. We've got the whole thing. We've now got a proper organisation to see the place through. When we started, God, we had nothing. But what drove it was enthusiasm. It ain't going to go down the drain. Stop. That's it. Simple story.
You can't ever thank everyone or acknowledge everyone that's been part of this, because it has been a cast of thousands, hasn't it?
Oh, yes.
But everyone gave us their loyalty, and so determined. It was like a attack of measles. It went through everybody. We all caught it, and nobody was going to let that park suffer. Mm. Nobody let that park down. We were going to save the park, come what may. It didn't care how we do it, we were going to do it.
Final thought. When you look at the success that it's become now, and you look back at the last 21 years, what do you feel?
What I feel is thank you very much to all those people who so loyally supported us. Yes. It's a lot of support of all the people who supported us and got us through, literally. We sometimes sit up in the house with the roof fell in. Now what the hell are we going to do? Another problem just come up. How the hell are we going to manage this? Everyone says, it doesn't matter. The tours are going out. Let's get the tours out. Let's get going. Let's get the money. Keep going. And it was their enthusiasm that suddenly floated us through.
Any large establishment of 12,000 people is going to have a considerable social effect on the district around it. The locals were very good about it. Every girl who left school in the district was drafted into Bletchley Park. And I had known people for years. When it all came out, these people I'd known for years and had never said anything about it at all. They told the most astonishing tales.
The hills of them, which turned out to be mountains, which we climbed and got to the very top and thought it was a nice clear view.
It was like going up false summit. You get up to the top of the thing, you think that's the summit. When you get there, there's another one beyond.
and another.
Thank you very much. And thank you for the lovely cake. Thanks to the staff, volunteers and veterans of Bletchley Park who took part in this podcast. For more information, go to bletchleypark.org.uk or find us on iTunes. Also, follow us on Twitter, where we are at @BParkPodcast, and join our Facebook group. Thanks to Audioboo, who make this podcast possible. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.